Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Strong Source Podcast. And today we have a very exciting guest, and it's amazing to have her on the podcast, all the way from the USA. We're very excited to have you here, Kendra. Kendra Rose, General Mills. Well, you have to introduce yourself, but of course, I think it's going to be a really exciting podcast, because if you look at also the ingredients that a General Mills does, you have exposure on a lot of the commodities that are, well, have been on fire, are on fire, that have exposure massive. So, I mean, handling the risk, handling these commodities, trading them, it will be a very exciting time for you. So I think it's a perfect one to have a podcast with. So welcome to the Strong Source Podcast, Kendra.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So maybe it's nice, Kendra, if you can introduce yourself to the audience a bit about how did you end up here and what you're doing.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, I lead commodities risk management, market insights, and communications at General Mills, which, if you ask me, is kind of a mouthful of a title, and it spans a couple of different things at General Mills. I have spent the last 12 years of my career at General Mills. I would say the bulk of that experience has been mostly in more like commodities and procurement type role. And so I've bought wheat, I've bought sugar, I've bought dairy, I have bought natural and organic ingredients, and kind of had a footprint over in our sustainability and regenerative agriculture work. And most recently now I've been in this role for just about 2 years now, leading overall market insights and risk management more within the commodities and the sourcing team. So we can unpack, I'm sure, all of that here throughout our conversation here today, but that is a glimpse of me professionally. On the personal side, I live in Minneapolis, where General Mills is the base. I have a husband named Zach, and we have two kids. I've got a son who is 5 and a daughter who is 3. So they keep us busy these days. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, "Hey, what are your hobbies?" And I was like, I don't think I have any hobbies anymore. Outside of that, it's a lot of kid stuff these days. But maybe a fun fact I'll share. My husband and I, we like to sail those sailboats. And we have kind of sailed in various different destinations all around the world. I would say the Caribbean is probably our favorite. So if you've got an audience that is interested in sailing, I'm always interested in the next hot destination from that standpoint. So that's a bit about me.
Very nice. Welcome.
Okay, good. So I know General Mills. I've been at General Mills, I think, four straight years, but the last time was just before you arrived at General Mills. So that's a pity that didn't meet you in that capacity. Because what I did was something which was called the Cocoa Powder Tour. And it was 4 years straight traveling the U.S., doing presentations about the cocoa market, cocoa industry, and a specific focus on cocoa powder. And the thing is, I had never heard about General Mills. And because it is in Minneapolis and such a large customer, I visited General Mills. And that was very good good experience. So what you didn't mention yet in the introduction is that you actually started in Cargill.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I found very interesting is that you started in OTC derivatives sales. So in essence, complex option structures to help customers manage their price risk. But they're sold as really interesting price management solutions. Now, my question is, coming out of university, how did you end up in such a role, which normally ends up more with more experienced people? Can you share with us a bit how it went?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Martijn, because sometimes I still ask myself that question sometimes too. It's like, how did I land here? What happened? I'll back up to university. So I went to college at the University of Minnesota, which is based in Minneapolis. I had several internships throughout college with Cargill. I had 2 of them. The first was in a soybean processing plant in Sydney, Ohio. So that is a booming place to be when you're 20 years old. But I spent a summer down there, and that was my first I would say, foray into commodities markets and cash commodities markets. I back up a step further. I grew up in a really rural area. My grandparents were farmers. I grew up around where our Christmas dinners and Thanksgiving dinners were talked about, you know, how the corn crop is, maybe it wasn't developing anymore, but what the corn crop was, where we're pricing corn, where they're going to sell corn, you know, all of that stuff. And that was just kind of on my periphery always. And same thing in my community. There's just a lot of farmers in my community. And so when I got to Sydney, Ohio that summer, I sat on the merchandising desk and I talked to farmers all day long buying their soybeans and really got to understand kind of the nuts and bolts of how cash merchandising and cash grain works. Mm. And I think that was the spark in me where I was like, gosh, this is cool. This is interesting. And what I loved about that too, no day was the same. It was always different. And it was the summer of 2008, actually. And so, I mean, soybean prices had hit $14 and farmers were ecstatic that they could sell their soybeans for $14. I got a little bit more exposure to the meal markets as we were trying to think about how to merchandise more of like the feed side. But I would say that was just kind of my first exposure to Cargill as a whole and commodity markets as a whole. So I finished up that internship and then fast forward to the following summer, I said, I want to stay in this area. Like, I don't really want to go try something different because like, I like this, but is there something else within Cargill that is similar, but might give me somewhat of a different experience? And so I applied for this role actually in trading within Cargill Risk Management, which is the business I was working in at that point in time. And the guy who was interviewing me, I think we both knew maybe, you know, two questions into the interview, like, this is not a fit. I would say that trading desk is really more focused on, like, they're more looking for kind of that quant and like engineering heavy math background, right? As they're managing an entire book of options and all the Greeks and everything that goes around that. So that's the skill set that sat in that trading business at that time. So he said, you know what? This is interesting though, because we've got another internship opening on our marketing desk. Mm-hmm. Our marketing and sales desk that I'm just going to go see if the hiring manager is free today. Like, let me go grab him. So they walk in and they interviewed me for that job instead. And they said, yeah, come spend the summer with us and learn this side of the business. And so I interned there for a summer and started learning the ins and outs of options and financial markets and OTCs and derivatives. And, you know, I was, you know, certainly not client facing at that point in time at all. So I was doing a lot of shadowing. And at that point, so that came to a close. And at the end of the summer, I kind of had to decide, like, is this the place I want to stay or do I want to go back into grain trading and merchandising? And at the time, I really wanted to be in Minneapolis. I was young. I didn't really want to move to a rural town in the middle of Iowa or Indiana. And when you're 22 years old and single. So I took the job in Minneapolis and I said, I'm probably going to learn quite a bit here and let's do it. Let's roll. So I spent they awarded me a full-time job. So I went back there and I worked on the North American food team and essentially worked kind of with two separate groups of clientele. The biggest one I would say was actually internal Cargill business units. Mm. And so as they are managing their internal trading books and then maybe also some of their integrated risk management programs for their customers, they would use these tools to kind of help optimize the positions that they would take within that. And so that was, I would say, probably the bread and butter of what I did for the most part. So it was more internal facing the internal Cargill business unit. My manager at the time, he was doing all the interfacing with, say, like the Crafts and the, you know, the Mondelez's of the world and the Nestle's of the world, right? Like these larger food companies and mid-sized food companies as well. And so I got a lot of exposure to that side of the work there too. So I was tasked with drumming up new business on both internally and then also had a small subset of smaller food-based accounts externally that I worked with. And just kind of landed in that space. So I did that for 3.5 years and I am still to this day so grateful for that experience because there is nowhere else that gives you such a deep immersion in financial markets and the world of options. Options are confusing and complex, and especially the stuff we were doing in that space. And I'm just thankful for the all the learning and just the richness in learning that happened. I got to see both how internal Cargill works, but I also got to have kind of a snapshot into like, how does this work externally in other companies that need to manage risk for the commodities that they're buying.
Do you think, by the way, of the that the managing of the risk, because you started already quite some years ago in the beginning already in managing risk, has it changed over time? Or is the way we manage risk still relatively similar to what it is now?
You know, I think, yes, I do. I think it's changed over time. I think about just reflecting on some of these complex option structures that were being floated around in the, you know, the mid to early 2000s. Those businesses have evolved to be much more vanilla, and I think for good reason. At this point in time. So I think it's changed. I think the way that you manage risk, you just have to approach it a little bit differently. The volatility is much higher than maybe what it was back then. The external forces in the market, you can chop up and down every single day, high, low, back again. And it, I mean, markets are quite humbling these days, truthfully. And so I think you just have to be prepared for a bigger subset of outcomes than maybe what you thought could happen, say, like 10 years ago, right? Markets weren't predictable then, but there were at least a few things that you were looking at that could give you a decent idea of what was going to happen. Today, I mean, a tweet or a, you know, it can change the market, truthfully. And there's no way to predict some of that more like black swan type stuff that we're seeing floating around. So I think it just takes a more robust approach than maybe what you were doing before.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, I got to know General Mills, but I think I assume quite a lot of people in our audience, they don't know the company. It's probably not well known in Europe. So could you please give us an overview of what this company is all about?
Well, don't forget the brands that you guys have. If people hear them, they instantly know, you know, that's go, Kendra, because you got the best chocolate ice cream in the world.
Yeah. We'll talk about ice cream here in a second. I used to buy the dairy that goes into that ice cream. So yeah. So General Mills is, you know, we're 160 years old, almost 160 years old. And yes, I would say our biggest footprint is in North America. So we've got fairly iconic brand that exists in the US, Canada for the most part, but we also have a footprint over in Europe, Australia, and then Asia as well, and then a little bit in LATAM too. So I would say, you know, the brands that you'll recognize are going to be, you know, we've got a really big cereal business. So, you know, think Cheerios and Lucky Charms and Cocoa Puffs and the, you know, things that you maybe ate as a child growing up, or at least I did here in the US. We did have the yogurt business that's in the process of being divested, as you all know. So yogurt is not a huge footprint that we have anymore. And then we've got a really big snacks business. So thinking like Nature Valley granola bars, Lara bars, and a variety of other snacking items under those brands. And then meals and baking, which are things with the kind of two separate buckets of products there. You've got more like soups and kind of those like hearty meals. And then you've got things like baking mix. So, you know, Betty Crocker baking mix or frostings or brownie mix all of those things are there too. So I think, yeah, we've got a giant footprint. Häagen-Dazs is another one of our brands, Häagen-Dazs ice cream. Nestle licenses the brand here in the US, but we own and operate the brand in the rest of the world with a few exceptions here and there, but lots of big, big stuff. Old El Paso, taco shells, taco kit, salsas. That might be another brand that you're familiar with. That's also global for us as well. Yeah.
It's massive. How do you, I mean, you manage all the risk, get all these ingredients. I mean, it's not just like only one part of the ingredients core. No, you got the whole variety. How do you deal with that? Yeah, how do you manage that?
Yeah, so maybe let me share a little bit about my team and kind of how we operate today. So I have, you know, I've got a team of analysts that are, you know, much smarter than me, to say the least. We cover, you know, obviously all of the grain commodities. So thinking about corn and wheat and soybeans, a lot in the veg oil space as well. As you think about palm and soybean oil, we, you know, and then we've also got analysts that are focused more on the soft side. So thinking cocoa, sugar. And then I also got an analyst who's focused on packaging as well. And so you think about like the packaging exposure that we have, resin-based packaging, fiber-based packaging, metal, for, you know, things like soup can, are all things that, you know, we're paying attention to on a day-to-day basis. So my team is really in charge of, you know, keeping a pulse on the markets. There, you know, I think it's a healthy balance between analyzing the data that we have access to and then also kind of creating our own data to come to our own conclusions on what do we think is going to happen. And then also, I think equally important is I'm pushing my team really hard. We've got to keep an ear to the ground. We've got to stay involved in these markets in some way, shape, or form. You cannot predict what a market is going to do or have a really good understanding of what a market is going to do by just reading a report or a wire or a news article every day. We have to stay really connected into our broker communities and the individuals that are really plugged into the trade. And so we're kind of spanning or straddling kind of those two buckets of work. And so as then we think about it, those insights then will bubble up in support of kind of two key groups within General Mills, I would say, mostly and mainly sourcing and procurement. And so we work right alongside our buying team to help guide on coverage decisions, various different strategies that we want to take within the market. So we're lockstep with those individuals. And then we also do a little bit of support as well for our business unit. So thinking like our core businesses. So thinking, you know, the snacks team and the baking team and the cereal team, and really helping them understand what are the dynamics in the markets and how should they think about their overall P&L based on, you know, what might be coming at them. So that's where I think, so I also have kind of this bucket of work underneath me. We call it comms or communication. And that essentially is kind of the link to all of it links external market insights and a variety of other topics that we pull into that, into the businesses. And we do that in a way that our businesses can really understand. Because talking to you guys about the dynamics of a corn market, or talking to, say, my boss about the dynamics of the corn market, you have to have very different messaging and very different talking points when you're talking to a marketer who's trying to figure out their P&L. And so we're kind of straddling both of those worlds right now and helping the broader organization understand what's happening externally. What do we think is going to happen? How are we looking around the corner? And then how are we making the appropriate plans and strategies to be competitive in the marketplace going forward?
Yeah. I have a question. Maybe it's too specific for you, but I'm quite interested in it. When we talked on the trading floor about our clients, so mostly fast-moving consumer companies, let me put it that way. We always talked about their futures price cover, because a lot of these commodities they trade on unpriced basis, whereby clients can buy basis. It can be like a soybean oil basis or meal basis or cocoa butter ratios, what have you, right? At the end of the day, they need to, the chocolate confectionery companies, but also other fast-moving consumer companies, they need to buy futures at the end of the day in exchange of the physical product. Now, when markets are not dramatically volatile, and we talked about it in the beginning of the podcast, where you said, yeah, markets have become more unpredictable, more volatile. Kind of in the old days, you could say, well, I'm thinking about my likelihood of selling 9 or 12 months out to a retailer. I think I'm going to run that capacity at full. But that is something else than a committed sale. Now, my question is, in the old days, you could be covered against your capacity. You could have a decent view about what margin that would reflect. Nowadays, markets have become so volatile that actually you need to think about your futures cover. Is that actually a long or an outright long versus unsold capacity? Or do you need to be very conscious that you really need to compare it to a committed sales? So what I'm saying is there is a difference into looking at your true exposure when markets are very volatile in terms of, are you long versus capacity, hedged, or are you long versus committed sales? Is that correct? Is that a good assessment for me? Or do you look at it differently?
Yeah, and I probably can't share too much around how we look at that. But what I will say is there's a process in place for us to assess that. And so thinking about, we've got guardrails and guidelines and limits in place that help us think through, okay, what do we have? What does our business need? And what is the situation that our business is in? And then how do we match that up and marry that up with the hedging strategy then that we might deploy? And so it exists. I probably can't go into too much detail beyond that, though.
Yeah. You see at times companies and listed companies reporting, for example, a P&L on derivatives in isolation. But in isolation, it doesn't mean much, right? You need to know. Yes. And it's the same. I sometimes got a question from someone in finance. And they said, Martijn, why are you losing so much on your hedges?
Well, look at my fiscal.
There is the other side, is the cash side. Yeah, so I may be short, and still I'm a happy camper that I'm losing on that short, because the basis position is making a lot of money, right? And the basis position I need to manage with future shorts, because it's impossible to run everything as a flat price position. Now, and I think also that's what you said about communications. It's important that you provide the right guidance towards the top of the house, what these results mean.
Exactly.
Huh?
Yep, yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, the important thing to note here too is we have a heavy footprint in commodities, certainly. We also have a heavy footprint in things that are not traded. So I'm, you know, thinking about things like fruit and vegetables and nuts and, you know, a lot of, you know, packaging. You know, there's not futures market for vitamins or, you know, things like that. So I think we have to kind of take, you know, that derivative, to your point, Martijn, that derivative position kind of in stride, because there are so many other things within the broader P&L that we are trying to manage in support of our businesses that use things beyond just the commoditized ingredients. Yeah. So if you think about it, like, my team is one input. The spend that we manage is arguably probably the most volatile, just given the nature of the market. So that's where, to your point, you know, the communications become that much more important as we're trying to figure out, like, okay, what's going to happen as we look around the corner here.
But how does then, for example, for the products that you just mentioned, I know, I saw on the website broccolis, or you see fruits, or products that don't have that range of you know, risk tools, and they don't have derivatives of it. What is then the menu card that actually a company like General Mills can have? Not so much which one you use, but more like, what's the menu that FMCGs in general can have if you have, because everybody has products that probably that don't have derivatives, that don't have OTCs or futures.
Yeah, that's where we think more broadly about category management as a whole, right? So if you're a buyer and you're leading, you know, the vegetable category or the vitamin category or whatever it may be, there are various different, we ask our buyers to pull together a category strategy every year. We should understand where our suppliers, I would say it's much more of a handheld partnership with the suppliers that we then have to do, you know, yes, we'll do some price discovery, but there are other things that are other levers that we'll pull within those categories that maybe can drive cost savings in the future, or, you know, or maybe we don't, right? Like we're just trying to stay lockstep with those suppliers and the industry as a whole to understand, okay, what are the dynamics in the industry? And I would say a lot of those insights come through the market participants that participate in that industry versus, like, I've never seen a wire on broccoli, for example. And I don't, maybe one exists, but we don't do a lot of that here in-house. We rely on our buying team to do that.
Hey, we have a lot of young people listening to the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I regularly receive mails on LinkedIn from young people about, you know, how do I break into the commodity industry? And a nice, I think, yeah, result of, for example, coffee and cocoa now getting mainstream. Yeah, you read it in the normal media, is that it interests more people. Yet it's still somewhat of an closed industry, and that was also one of the reasons that we started this podcast. Now, what kind of advice do you give to young people who listen to you and say, hey, that's an interesting story, and it's an interesting job. How do I break into that industry? And what are the things that, General Mills and you are looking for?
Yeah. So what I would say, first, I always encourage people when they're like, I really want to do that. And I ask them why. What is it about commodities or markets in general that interests you? Mm-hmm. And that question can sometimes stump people. They're like, it's strategy, it's strategic. And my response to that is like, I don't know if you really understand what this entails. I think, markets and commodities, and maybe this is just my perception of it, because, this is kind of my experience with younger applicants as well. Commodity markets, it's like the sexy part of, buying in agriculture, right? Like it's interesting. It's, it has kind of this like halo around it for sure. And you want to be able to sift out like who's in it because it sounds cool versus who's in it because they're actually really interested in it. Yes. And where I struggle sometimes, like as I think about, talent and overall talent strategy, like you need people who really, really find this stuff interesting. Yeah. And so my question, the question when I ask people this, I'm like, really do some reflection. Why do you think this is interesting? What is it about, your perception of commodities and commodities trading or risk management or buying or whatever it may be that feels interesting to you? Because the fact of the matter is you've got to be highly analytical, a really, really good critical thinker, be able to handle lots of sets of data and be able to sift through like what's real and then what's kind of not or total BS. You're going to have to figure out all of these things that like the actual trading part is a product of the work that you do. It is not the work that you do. And I tell people this all the time, like trading's one sliver of this, but the work that goes behind creating a bias, having conviction in your perspective, understanding and building a network and relationships that are going to support you when you've got questions or when you want to kick around different ideas, that's the work. And so sometimes when I talk to people about this, they're like, oh, okay, that's maybe a little different. It's not just sitting at my screen and looking at my Bloomberg all day long and, hitting buttons and trading. So I think just helping them understand the why. And then if you can get past that and they're like, all right, yeah, I get that. And I'm still in, I would say start networking the crap out of, everybody around you that that are in commodities. And I especially encourage this in women and young women, because I don't think that we have enough women in commodities and commodities trading. I would love to see more. And I think this field just certainly needs a little bit more diversity in it as you think about the players that make it up today. And so I think we can all get better if you could pull more diverse perspective and diverse thoughts into the conversation that maybe had.
I think it's a very well articulated answer, and I'm very happy with it. I could almost use it as a default explanation on the Vesper website. That's something that I often say when people ask me. I said, look, you naturally need to have this interest in it. And if I look back at this, also learning by doing and what really interests you. So if I can make a small example, I started on the vegetable oil desk, which I really thought was exciting. And I started, I talked to customers like Unilever, and that was a very sophisticated client. Then at some stage, they switched me over to sunflower meal, and then I needed to talk to pig slaughterers, and that I didn't like that at all. So it's also a matter of figuring out, what part of the job do you like, which kind of players do you like. I like the intellectual challenge of making sense out of complexity with intelligent people, right? Now, yeah. But one thing you haven't mentioned yet, but I'm very curious on how you manage that, and that is the psychological part of this business, meaning you're in the weekend, you have a nice get together with your family, and you get an email.
It's Super Bowl week,
and something like that, and you get that email, and this is not good for a certain position. And I've had that in the past very often. Some kind of a shit show in Ivory Coast happened, and I knew my Monday was going to be ruined. How do you personally deal with the intensity of the job? So the enormous pressure, financial stress at times, but also having to escalate somewhere a position towards the higher echelons? How do you deal with that?
It's a really great question, Martijn. It's not a job that you just kind of sail through. That's where I go, actually, sailing to get away from that. But I think the psychological intensity of it, and yes, I've certainly had that moment too, where it's like you get something over the weekend and you get something on a Friday afternoon. You're like, oh, this is not going to be good. And for me, thankfully for me, I learned a lot of those lessons early on. And, you know, so we didn't cover a whole lot, but I spent, you know, a couple of years cash trading wheat. And so when I came over to General Mills in 2013, I spent almost 2 years trading cash wheat. And I would say those are probably the moments where like it really got interesting. You know, there's maybe 12 feet of snow up in the Dakotas and none of my trains were moving. And it's like, crap, what am I going to do now? But those were really, really important and pivotal learning moments for me, because I think it reiterated a couple of things. One, your best laid plans may never work out the way that you want them to. And so that goes back to like maintaining this level of agility. But one of the things then that I carried through, one of the things that I learned from those experiences over the years, is this is why I so strongly believe that communications and the way that we articulate the strategies and the positions that we're taking are so important. Because if you can bring the people along with you on what you are doing, why you are doing it, what the assumptions were at the time that you took that position, and like have them kind of walk that journey with you, you've got a whole bunch of air cover then when those situations hit you.
Yeah.
So that happens now all the time, right? But we come back to and say, okay, here's what we aligned on given this set of assumptions. Yeah. Now this set of assumptions is true. How do we pivot? And we give ourselves, you know, that kind of like leeway to say, all right, like we need to move in this direction now. But I think the key to that, and what keeps me sane truly, is like, I so believe in over communication of the strategies and making sure that the people who know or who will be impacted by the outcomes of the strategies are lockstep aligned with what me and my team are doing and what we're recommending on a day-to-day basis. So that kind of keeps me sane. I think, you know, there's still moments too, where it's like, you can't get past that. Or it's like, oh shoot, maybe I missed this or maybe I missed that. Like I said before, markets are very humbling, and I've certainly had those moments. And so at that point in time, you also have to like give yourself a little bit of grace. You're not going to get everything, and you're not going to get everything right. And so I tell my team that all the time also, where we are going to miss stuff, and we do, right? Everyone does. And, or we're going to get stuff wrong, and we do, and everybody does. And so we've just got to give ourselves a little bit of grace as we go through this, but also like making sure that we're over communicating those assumptions as we go along.
It's not easy to give yourself a grace, because every day, especially on the futures market, you see the low and you see the high.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that you haven't optimally traded that. Mm-hmm. Right? But this is also extremely well articulated, and I like it, because I often say to companies who want to talk to me about risk management, is that I've become so disciplined in talking about analysis, game plan, and execution. If you go through that process in a very disciplined way, and also you report it, you take informed decisions. And you can, if things go wrong, you say, well, look, this was the process. This is what we followed. And you can also look at where the variables have changed or where not, whereby you can say, well, nothing has changed. We can actually increase our exposure or reduce, right?
Yeah, or we ride this out, because the data is telling us a different story than what the market is. And that's very true. That happens to us all the time. And so, you've got to, you kind of...
But Kendra, do you always have the time to write it down? Do you have the time to, in these markets where they've been, do you have the time to administrate, okay, these were the steps, this was nice what you've done, right? In theory, Martijn, what you're saying, Kendra, I mean, just challenging you, but it's like... Yeah, and it sounds like that's the great plan, right? That's how we do it. Mm-hmm. But you know how a day goes. You know how hectic it can be in the market suddenly. Then you have to make a decision, maybe just by calling, discussing, doing it.
Yep. You, some cases, yes. But I think, you know, we're agile and nimble enough, I think, where we've got processes in place where if we've got to go change the plan or go change the assumption, it can be a quick thing. And I think that the key to that is you've got to have the process in place to do that. You can't just be like, oh, shoot, like now we're changing the plan. That doesn't go over well with the people, you know, the powers that be. And so you've got to have if we need to change the plan, here's the process that we follow. And here's the expectation for the people around me that need to align to that and the timeline that they do that. And we have all that in place. And so do I have time? No, I don't really have time for anything these days, but I do have a team that is really well, you know, versed on the processes and making sure that we all stay lockstep working together on it.
And the topic that you touched base on, women in trading or women in finance, commodities. Now, you have a long, successful career. You are completely in the zone, on top of your game. You know, you can be an inspiring example for women. Now, what is it why you think you really enjoy it, why you've become successful? And apparently it is not so easy to attract women easily to this super interesting industry.
Yeah, I think so. The things that I enjoy about it, no day is the same. And the variety of the things that can pop up in your day and the problems that you have the opportunity to solve every day, so interesting to me. And it's generally problems that people maybe have solved before, but it's like the actual nuances of that problem aren't going to repeat themselves over time, right?
Yeah.
So I love that. As I've moved up in my career, my favorite thing is working with analysts and risk managers and developing them so that they can, I mean, ideally, like they take my jobs one day, right?
Yeah.
And I love that. I love the people management. I love the development in that. And I think it's so important to make sure that we've got a team, you know, that is, you know, that we hire for skill, but we, you know, develop or manage for gap, right? And so thinking about, all right, like we need you to maybe, you know, you've got really good skills in this, but we need to help develop and manage you over here. I love that dynamic. I also think, you know, going back to your question, you know, why don't women pursue this as a career?
Yeah.
I wish I had a better answer for the why behind that, but I've got a hunch. And I think the environment that can sometimes be like those entry-level trading jobs, it's not a place where like women can necessarily feel like they belong. And so we talk a lot about belonging at General Mills. And so, you know, belonging, think about the environment that you're in when you truly, truly belong to something or somewhere. You yourself, you share your ideas, you have psychological safety to operate. And I think, you know, some of early on in the, you know, the trading desks that I worked on, you know, more so on Cargill, like that wasn't really the case where I was like, you know, I'm the youngest. I'm one of the only women. It feels kind of like this old boys club. And we need, and I was just kind of like out on this island, and I would go find other women to kind of commiserate about this phenomenon with. And as I've moved up in the organization, my intent here is like, this is such a cool place and women can totally do it.
Yeah.
We got to bring more people and more women into this space. And so we've got to help them feel like they belong in this space. And that is the role not only of women like me bringing them up, but it is also the role of the men in the industry. And you could say this about any other minority, right? Who's trying to get in, right? But like, we need sponsors. We need allies. We need people who can kind of walk this along with us and can say the things that and be champions for women when they're not in the room to be champions for themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that gets really hard when you've got one group of people that kind of is leading the charge in most places. Yeah.
I have another question.
Yeah.
And that is about career progression. So my life was on the trading desk. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why I survived so long in a corporate setting, because I didn't need to think so much about politics and saying the right things, right? Mm. As long as you make money, as long as you hire great talent, you can stay around for a long time. And sometimes when I spoke to people, kind of the higher echelons, I needed to adjust to a certain vocabulary. Now, Can you tell me a little bit how you manage the, the thin air of corporate life, being effective in a complex or organization? Because that is for people who want to progress their career and maybe not like me, spend 25 years on a trading desk, but want to be successful in a large corporate, you need to have certain capabilities. You mentioned a little bit networking, but can you share with us a bit how you've learned and developed over time? And maybe you got protected, or maybe you got help, or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely have had some really good coaches on this along the way. I think, early on, my overarching answer to this is you've got to be able to simplify the complex. And it goes back to when you're in a room, most of the people that you're explaining something to because you need action or a decision on something or alignment on something, they are not going to be as deeply into the weeds as you are on that.
Yeah.
And I tell this to my team all the time too, right? And so they are deep, deep in the markets on, what's going on in palm oil and what's going on in the packaging markets, right? I don't have time to get that deep with them. I can go a little bit deep, but I can't go that far deep. If we need to do something, or you need me to action something, or if I need to take it to my managers to action something, you've got to be able cipher out what are the key points, how do you simplify the complexity of what you're trying to tell me, and then how do you very succinctly talk to me about impact and what action we should take. And if you can follow that storyline in a way that is compelling, demonstrates conviction in your perspective, and ultimately can get people rallied around it and inspired around what your idea is, that's the trick. And I think that's a soft skill that takes practice to build over time. And, thankfully I spent, 3 years in a role where that's kind of all I did, truthfully, was trying to decipher, in the height of inflation, it's coming at us like a freight train. We're like, we got to get in front of our businesses and talk to them about markets in a succinct way. And then talk to them about what this means for the price of granola bars on the shelf.
But I think that's a super tough job to do, to explain to somebody who's not in the market, but is very important for the process and for the decision-making process to the market has been super volatile. Some things are sentiment, some things are factual driven, some things you don't know. And you just say that, but yeah, therefore we need more budget, or we need this approval, or there's more risk. And that's not just you. A lot of companies will have that probably. Is that something that could be arranged differently, do you think, than that it's only with the commodity team that you get more responsibility, actually? Could that thing?
Yeah, for sure. And I think I came into role here, June of 23. So I've been here for almost 2 years. We are in the process of kind of rebuilding the processes by which we operate. And those are very real questions that we ask ourselves all the time. Like, how do we make sure that we have enough agility and freedom to operate so that we can react to whatever the market is throwing at us versus like working our way up on this ladder of decision rights that, may exist because somebody needs to be informed. There's certain thresholds by which we have to do that, and certain situations where we have to do that. But I would say in totality, my goal is we should be pushing as much freedom to operate back into the people that are closest to the markets and the actual doers of the work, right? Generally, in general, are going to take the recommendation of whatever we think. But it is also how there is value, I will say, in having those discussions, because sometimes it can get really easy. We get caught in our own echo chamber sometimes, where it's like, okay, like here's kind of what the team thinks. Taking it outside of the team to kind of toss around those ideas and get challenged on that is something I actually really love. And I think that there's value in that we talk about productive discourse all the time at General Mills. There's value in diversity of thought and diversity of perspective.
Yeah.
And I think bringing those elements in makes our decision-making process a lot better.
That's an interesting expression, productive discourse.
Yeah, you bet.
Now, throughout your career, you meet a lot of interesting people. They come and go, but what are some of the key things that you're happy with, that you learn from? It could be, let me say, leaders that you that you met in General Mills.
Yeah. I will tell a story of my very first boss at General Mills. I was a wheat merchant. I was trading the wheat for our flour mill in Buffalo, New York. So I was trying to get wheat from the middle of North Dakota in a country elevator all the way to Buffalo, New York in January. And oh, by the way, there was like 12 feet of snow on the ground. So trains were not moving. I could not, trucks don't drive that far. It was just, we were like just battling to try and get wheat. And there was an opportunity that I had to get the wheat, to get a whole train of wheat moving to Buffalo. It was sitting in Chicago and I'm like, okay, like we're gonna do this. And so I bought it and I sent it to Buffalo. And it was maybe 20 minutes later that I figured out that I had paid way too much money, way too much money for that wheat. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and you know, you get those feelings and your heart just sinks.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, like now what am I going to do? And so I said, okay, like I got to go tell my boss. I've got to go tell her and I've got to go tell her what happened. And I got to go, like, we got to figure this out. Mm-hmm. So I walked into her office and I will never, ever forget her reaction. And I said, look, I explained the situation to her and I said, here's the impact. And she said, she just looked at me and she shrugged her shoulders and she's like, okay, well, what'd you learn? And that meant so much to me at the time.
Because you expected like a whole different story, conversation.
Totally. Yeah. It's like, what did you do? Why did you do that? What are we going to do now? Right. And yes, like she then helped me work through it. Right. But her first reaction was like, okay, like, well, what did you learn? And the best managers that I have had do two things. They give me the freedom to fail. And then they give me the air cover to go fix whatever I maybe failed at. And like, they'll kind of cover my, you know, the messaging up or the messaging across or whatever it may be. And I'll never forget that. And that's kind of how I think about managing my team today. I try and give them the freedom to fail. And we talk about test and learn all the time. So you've got an idea, like let's test it out and then let's debrief on what'd you learn.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I will be so thankful for that one experience because it was probably like the worst trade I've ever made in my entire life, to be honest. But it was her reaction that like will stick with me forever. And so I think recognizing like people are human. We need to fail, but we need to fail fast and then move on. Right. Like there's no benefit to anybody for lingering on failures. They're learning lessons that, you know, will accumulate for us over time. So I'd say that's one thing. The other thing too, I'll mention, you know, I had another manager that we talk a lot about like authenticity is like a big buzzword, you know, in corporate America today, like show up as your authentic self, right? And I think the next step to authenticity is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I had this boss and she showed up as herself every single day, but she also had this degree of vulnerability to her that instilled so much trust in her team. She talked openly about her failures. She talked openly about like who she was or what she was struggling with. She talked openly about her own individual development plan and like the things that she was trying to work on and improve. And just having visibility to a leader on like, hey, you're struggling with some of this stuff too, gave us or me like working on her team the freedom to do the same things. And it was amazing what happened. Like we just had a really high trust, high performing team then over time. And so I think wrapping those two up together, like I think about pulling both of those into my own leadership style today on like give my team freedom to fail, be vulnerable and build trust with them. And then I think we all kind of operate a lot better when we've got that psychological safety around whatever it is we're trying to do.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That's really nice. Hey, and Kendra, I mean, we're coming a bit to the end of the podcast here.
Yeah.
I would love to know what drives you every day. Is it, is the people? Is it the results? Is it the final amazing products General makes? What drives you?
What drives me? I think for me, my litmus test for whether or not I think I am in, if I'm like doing the right thing or if I like need to move on and do something else in my career is, am I still having fun? And I think anytime there have been certain moments in my career where I have been like, I'm not having fun anymore. And, you know, that happened to me at Cargill. And so that was kind of my catalyst to say, like, I think I need to go do something else. Mm-hmm. And I say this to my boss all the time. Like we talk, you know, all the time about, you know, various different things. And I tell her, even on the hard days, I'm like, but I'm still having fun. And so fun for me is the work is interesting. And it's like, I go back to the, what I said earlier, it's changing every day. And there's just something new and different every day. And I don't live the same day over and over and over again. That's fun for me. My team is fun. I think it's so important to work with a group of people that you like to be around and hang out with, you know, on a day-to-day basis. You spend 40 hours a week with these people, like you should probably like them. Yeah. And I think it's worth investing the time and building the relationships with them. And I would say that about the people that report to me, but I also say that about my peer set across the board too. Like you've got to build those relationships. And I would say those, the people that I work with, I mean, they make me laugh every day, and we try and have a little bit of fun while we're dealing with these like very serious big world topics. You can't take yourself too seriously. So you've got to just, I think, like roll with it. And at the end of the day, I had a boss at one point in time, he would always remind me, he said, Kendra, we are just making cereal and yogurt. We are not saving lives. Yeah. And to some extent, right? Like we're like, I'm not a, you know, and he was drawing a parallel to like being a neurosurgeon or something else, right? Like very like high stress job, but he's like, you know, put it in context. And I think, you know, for me, I try and do that on a day-to-day basis too, where this is a piece of my life. I am a human first, and you know, and an employee is another chunk of my life, but like we're all people at the end of the day, and we try and operate as such.
Thank you. I think it must be amazing to work in your team. So yeah, thank you very much for your time, and I learned a lot again, and thanks again for making a fantastic ice cream and all the beautiful products too. The cinnamon credentials were very good, so
if you haven't seen the latest mashup they've done, I think they did, and I can't believe they did this, but they did some Totino's pizza and Cinnamon Toast Crunch. So it's like pizza flavored Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Oh,
don't let the Italian hear it. The Italians, it's for them probably like seeing pineapple on their pizzas.
Exactly. Still trying to get my hands on that one, but the soup drops are the other one that has a little bit of buzz over here during cold and flu season in the U.S. But there's lots of cool stuff going on from the innovation standpoint.
Really, really nice. I think it was amazing to have you in this podcast. It was really, really cool. Your answers, you know, Martijn's going to use them as a default already, but also you're really humble, but you're super impressive, very smart. The things that you do in the meantime, you're running at home a family as well, and then this team in these kind of times, it's a lot that comes to your plate. And I think what I also have in my own team is that fun part, and you described really well, right? It's not laughing the whole day, but it's exactly what you say. So yeah, I really, really appreciate it. And I think you're a real inspiration for a lot of other women to join this amazing commodity industry and to have a peek in what it takes to be in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to support along the way. I've had a lot of people who have reached out and supported me along the way. And we all need that, right? And so I'm here for it.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.